Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 14th of November 2020. This podcast is going to be the third one in the series What is Fascism? This one deals with the economy. I'll just recap very briefly how we got to this point. In the first podcast in the series, I looked at historically occurring examples of fascism. Namely, the fascism of Italy of the 1920s, 30s and 40s, and the fascism of Germany, Nazism, of the 30s and 40s. Of course, both of these fascisms were deeply involved in the Second World War, the biggest, most widespread and violent war of world history. It's estimated that this war resulted in the deaths of around about 50 million people worldwide. It lasted for 6 years. In fact, the run-up to the war, the Spanish Civil War, the wars in China, between Japan and China and so forth, could be seen as a run-ups to the war. So, in fact, it lasted somewhat longer. It was followed by a Cold War between the West, the US and allies, and Soviet Russia and allies, and that lasted for over 40 years. It culminated in the only two uses in world history so far of nuclear weapons, in the bombing of Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. I would say, therefore, that war and the fascisms that were deeply implicated in it should loom large in your political imagination, and particularly if you've got any kind of historical sense of the way in which where we are now has grown out of where we were then. Certainly that war was so cataclysmic that its ripples still spreading out. So in that first podcast, I identified 11 features of fascism, actually historically occurring fascism. Now, if you look around the internet, you can get various analyses of what fascism is supposed to be. I think one pundit came up with 14 features. Umberto Eco did a very interesting account, having lived through the fascism of Italy in his childhood and youth. And I think he has rather a different account, overlapping but different account. I've also seen, interestingly, the stages of fascism, of how fascism comes about. And I did deal with that to some extent in the first podcast in this series. So I've looked at historically occurring fascism and noted down the what I take to be the chief features. I don't claim that it's exhaustive. I do claim that we can't really define fascism, particularly as it doesn't have a deep understructure of philosophy. There is no underpinning philosophy of fascism. It tends to be philosophically and rhetorically and polemically opportunistic. And this makes me think that the surface appearance isn't really what matters. The jackboots, the swastikas, the parades, the posturing, the macho posturing. A kind of surface appearances. Now, it seems to me that many of the main features of fascism that I identified can exist in societies that look nothing like fascist Italy or Nazi Germany. So in the next part, bearing that in mind, that point in mind, in the second part of What is Fascism, I took a look at UK society and American society and sought out examples in our contemporary societies at contemporary Western capitalist societies of the features of fascism that I'd found in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. And I had to search around for these features, both in incipient form, nascent form, and in developed form. And I did come to the conclusion that we can find many of the elements of fascism in our current day society. Now, the last feature that I identified was the economy. And I didn't deal with that in episode 2 of What is Fascism, because it seemed rather too big. And the podcast was already over 1 hour long. So I thought, well, the third episode of the series could deal with the economy. Now, what I'm going to do as a way in is take Benito Mussolini's characterisation of fascism, or at least his desired version of fascism, quite seriously. After all, he should know. He coined the term. He called his party the Fascist Party. Mussolini characterised the perfect fascist state as one in which state power and corporate power were completely entangled. Now, this isn't a vision of a society like Soviet Russia, where you had a kind of state capitalism and a command economy. Rather, Mussolini's vision was of a state in which capitalist corporations taking profits and employing workers and everything that we recognise as capitalism was present. And you could characterise fascism politically as the reaction of capitalism to the rising threat of some kind of socialist power or some kind of socialist takeover. And bear in mind that communist and socialist parties in Italy and Germany at the time of the rise of Italian fascism and German Nazism were doing quite well, did have followings, could possibly win elections, could possibly foment revolutions. After all, in 1917, the Russian Revolution had gone to completion and the Tsar had been deposed. And the Soviet state arose out of the ashes of that ferment. So fascism isn't like Soviet communism, even if you want to characterise Soviet communism as state capitalism. It's rather more favourable to standard corporate capitalism. And this characterisation was in fact the case. There was a deep, intimate entanglement of state power and corporate power. In Germany, the corporates thought that Italy would be the bloke to face down the socialists and communists, which of course he did rather well by rounding them up and putting them in concentration camps or assassinating them. But they did think that they could control Hitler at the same time. They thought he would be their useful idiot, and of course that was a fatal error, because he was having none of it. He did become very, very powerful, in fact, like the Führer, the dictator. We should note at this point that a fascist society is a mass society. In other words, it's a society in which the mass of people, particularly the workers, are regimented, are subjected to discipline by state power, do behave as a mass with a single identity. In the case of fascism, that identity is structured around allegiance to the nation and the leader, or maybe the nation stroke race, whatever that is, and the leader. This is a situation which is very convenient for capitalists who are operating within a fascist state. Now, communism famously is a mass society as well, and some people like to make this a point of comparison. But at least theoretically and ideally, a communist society determines its mass society character through allegiance to an economic class, to the people who actually produce the value in society through their labour. And this is a very fundamental difference. So what is the nature of this entanglement that Mussolini talks about? And bearing in mind our question that structured part two of this series, do we find that entanglement now in American society, in UK society? Now, I've already dealt with aspects of this in an episode of our series, Interesting Times, in which I talk about revolving doors of personnel between corporations, media and the state. And I document some examples of that in that particular podcast. I think that podcast was called Revolving Doors and Cozy Cabals. And that is dealt with there. So I'm not going to go too far into that in this one. Of course, there's the case of corporate donors. Certainly in the US, both parties can take unlimited donations from rich oligarchs, which they do. The oligarchs buy off both parties. There was an attempt to constrain donations legally to perhaps moderate or mitigate the power of extremely wealthy individuals, of billionaire oligarchs. But that was thrown out by the Supreme Court through an initiative called Citizens United. Pretty ironic, the name of that movement, since it enabled oligarchs to basically throw as much money as they want to lobbying and buying the political parties and buying the political system. Citizens United. Obviously, they are having a laugh. In the UK, it's rather different. There are some constraints, but they do get gamed. There are ways around them. And there is big money in UK politics, just the same. And certainly the revolving door is there as well. As I say, I would recommend that you get a listen to that podcast, Interesting Times, Revolving Doors and Cozy Cabals, because we find that there's all kind of nepotism going on and cronyism going on, and that's very much in the news at the moment. A lot of cronyism has been exposed in UK politics, particularly in the awarding of contracts to offer public service in relation to coronavirus, the global pandemic of COVID-19, to do with supplying PPE equipment and rolling out vaccine programs, rolling out test and trace programs, much of which has been handed to private companies, often without tender and with not that much transparency, and often to people who can be seen to have a relationship with the Tory party, with the government, in the form of being donors, relatives and so forth. There are myriad examples of this coming to light every day, and I suggest you do look into it, and it's pretty well documented. There are some alternative journalists exposing a lot of this stuff. There is also a number of legal cases outstanding on this matter. I think the Good Law Project is involved in challenging the government within the legal system over this matter. I understand that Caroline Lucas of the Green Party is behind one such action in conjunction with the Good Law Project. This is worth checking out. There's quite a lot of this stuff going on. In this podcast, though, what I'm going to do is actually look at a concrete example. I'm going to look at the relationship between Serco and the government. Now, Serco is a company that specialises in providing outsourced public services, which gets paid for its troubles out of public funds. Our money, I might say. And which pays profits and dividends to shareholders. So an example of, you might think, neoliberalism, in which everything is a matter of the market. So I'm going to look at that relationship through various documents. The first document that I looked at was a submission made by Serco's own think tank, which is called the Serco Institute, to the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee of the House of Commons, and which is signed by the CEO of Serco, Rupert Soames, and which is dated the 16th of February 2018. And the title of the paper is Sourcing Public Services, Lessons Learned from the Collapse of Carillion. Now, Carillion was a firm similar to Serco that provides public services under government contract. And it was particularly concerned with construction, building hospitals and so forth. And Carillion actually went bust, and a number of extremely expensive hospitals were left half-built. And it was very embarrassing to the government, I would say. And there was little notice that Carillion would go bust. And I think the directors were paid bonuses and all the rest of it. So it's often held up as an example of the way the Reagan-Thatcher doctrine that private is best and that government should be abolished as a provider of services to the public is actually totally spurious. The other paper that I read was a Cabinet Office paper, a policy paper, I suppose you call it, which was called The Outsourcing Playbook, and which was dated June 2020. This was a version 2 of the Outsourcing Playbook. There was a version put out by the Cabinet Office in the previous year. And my question is, does this paper, this government paper, this cabinet paper, take heed of the Serco submission, which reflects upon the whole matter of outsourcing and what needs to be done to avoid Carillion-type situations? In effect, what I'm doing is comparing these two documents and seeing if I can find an imbrication, an entanglement of the thought, the ideas, the pleadings of an extremely large corporation in a government document that purports to say how outsourcing should be dealt with, and the ins and outs and the balances of forces and the role of the market and the role of regulation and all the rest of it. Is there any resonance between these two documents which would indicate an entanglement at that level of policy making that would bring a smile to Mussolini's face? In other words, are we already fascist in the Mussolini sense of fascism? Before proceeding with the comparison, let me just signal the way this is going to go. Firstly, I'm going to identify four strong features that Rupert Soames brings to the fore in his Serco think tank paper. Then I'm going to see if I can find Solmes's recommendation is taken up in the cabinet paper of 2 years later, the government paper, The Outsourcing Playbook, June 2020. I will briefly give the detail, without getting too nitty-gritty, that demonstrates that in fact, yes, policy suggestions made by Serco are taken up by the government. After that, I'm going to return to the Serco document and look at it in a little bit more detail, in an attempt to discern the actual flavour, character of the relationship between a body like Serco and a body like the UK government. And there's a couple of things come out of that. And one is the way in which we need to use a system style of thinking to properly characterise that relationship. And I will draw upon there Whitehead's notion of process and Nietzsche's cosmological version of the will to power as a means of gaining a framework that elucidates the nature of the entanglement itself. So it's a bit of a meta-analysis of the kind of entanglement that occurs between corporations and governments. Now, flowing out of that is the matter of the exact nature of neoliberalism, of the idea that markets do everything better, that government should be minimal, if at all. In Reagan's words, you know, the government is the problem. On the one hand, and the overarching power of government that we see in fascism, on the other hand. And one is forced to a conclusion about the nature of neoliberalism, that in fact it's completely ideological, and that it conceals rather than reveals the nature of our situation, and that in fact it does, despite its aversion to big government, lead to the fascistic concentration of power in the hands of very few, served by vast baroque bureaucracies, which is the opposite of what it claims to be. So I'm going to just draw that out as well. So the principles that Serco recommends to government, there are four of these. First one is transparency. So the accounts need to be visible to the Cabinet Office and the National Audit Office. This means that the accounts of the company taking on the outsourcing of a public service in a government contract should have a high degree of transparency vis-a-vis its financial goings-on, its accounts. So its accounts should be visible. The second is that there should be an orderly exit principle. And this is the right to exit a contract. In other words, to break free of a contract, and that this should be orderly. It's kind of common sense, you know, if you're going to do this kind of thing, you would want, first of all, for the corporation involved not to be overly disrupted if it needed to exit a contract, but also for the government and the public who are availing themselves of the service in question, that shouldn't be inconvenienced either. The third is security of supply principle. In other words, there should be a living will, i.e. arrangements to hand over to another supplier should be made in advance should the corporation go bankrupt or break away from the contract through the orderly exit principle, or if the contract should befall some kind of ill luck of some sort or another. So the arrangements for handing over have to be made prior to the contract being awarded. The fourth principle identified by Serco is the fairness principle. And this says that there should be a mutually agreed code of conduct between the government and the contractor. Now, Can we now find those four principles in the outsourcing playbook, which the government published a couple of years after Serco published their desiderata? Okay, on page 42 of the outsourcing playbook, there's a section called Setting the Tone, Risk Allocation, and the Supplier Code of Conduct. And this applies basically to the fairness principle. In other words, that there should be a mutually agreed code of conduct. So this is actually what you find in the government document. The public expects that government and its suppliers will look after their interests and deliver on the promises that they make. They expect that suppliers will behave ethically and treat the end users of their service, employees and subcontractors fairly and with respect. Suppliers also expect that government will be fair and transparent in its dealings with them. So there you go. That's the principle of transparency and the principle of fairness. On page 34 of the government document, we notice that there is protection against supply chain risk, which are called novation agreements, and this applies to the security of supply principle. And there is also a resolution planning which deals with the same conundrum on page 50. On pages 50 to 52 of the government document. So you can see that at least three of those principles have been transferred across from Serco's think tank document to the government policy document. The orderly exit principle was a little bit harder to find, and I had to sort of delve into what's called the Model Services Agreement, version 1.09 of July 2020, which actually is what it says. It's a government document giving model service agreements, and these are model contracts. Now, this is a huge document. I think it's 800 pages or something, and it's written in legalese, and I've actually got better things to do, but I did, by some judicious searching, notice that there is an orderly exit principle written into these model contracts. And so those are covered in another document, a big legal document, that is referenced by the government document, the outsourcing playbook. So I've gone over that rather quickly, and because we could get bogged down in all kinds of nitty-gritty. But you can get these documents on the internet, and you can take a look. I've been through them with a fine-tooth comb. And corporations are in effect writing policy. They're not doing it completely on their own. There is a push and a pull between government and the corporations. And this is where I want to just expand on the idea of what the entanglement between government and corporations is in the contemporary UK. In some kind of like meta sense, in some sort of like high theoretical sense. Now, it seems to me that, and I take it as a kind of axiomatic, that we need to think that we're dealing with systems, in other words, with turbulent realities, flowing realities, situations of heraclitia and flux, when we talk about any kind of goings-on and try and get a clear picture of them and a serviceable picture of them that enables us to decide what we want to do about the situation that we're in. And all the rest of it. And it says to me, yes, you think in terms of process. You note that everything moves and changes and shifts and interacts. So rather than seeing the government corporation entanglement as some kind of single monolithic entity, we need to understand that it's a system composed of subsystems. A bit like the human body, it's organic. So in our bodies, we have our circulatory system, our nervous system, our digestive system. They're all of a piece, and they all depend on each other. But they also have their own independence at the same time. And so you see that comparing the Serco document with the government document, that we've got two partners in a marriage. Or we've got two cogs in a machine, perhaps. Even though perhaps the marriage metaphor is a little better because that is rather more organic and a bit less predictable than a mechanistic idea. So there is a push and pull of power. There is antagonism at certain points, but there are also alliances formed at certain points. And Nietzsche's idea of the will to power in its cosmological sense, in which existence is conceived of as being an absolute infinity of points of will to power, which attempt to maximise power to themselves, and they attempt to do it by forming alliance with other powers, but also by opposing other powers, overwhelming other powers, absorbing other powers, defeating other powers, repelling other powers. So this is, to my mind, an improvement on the Hegelian dialectic, which sees, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, where you're just dealing with simple contradiction, eventually somehow getting resolved. That the repertoire available to players, i.e. points of will to power, in this game of existence, is rather wider than simply opposition and synthesis, that it can contain alliances, repulsions, attractions, absorptions, overwhelmings, and so forth. And I think if you look at the Serco document, you can see all of these operations in play. But this is not to downplay the actual entanglement of corporations and the government. They remain distinct at the same time as being extremely mutually dependent. And for that mutual dependence to contain elements of antagonism, as well as elements of cooperation, as well as elements of mutual allegiance, and so forth. And understanding that power is at play here, actually the power of individuals playing out, individual politicians with their issues, individual corporate wallets, CEOs and so forth with their issues, individual actors in the market who want to avail themselves of services, and how they react to that, and how they push back against it when it's not so pleasant for them, and so forth. So that's something that looking at this document brings out. So let me just give a couple of examples, just to make the point. As I say, I'm not going to go line by line through it. It wouldn't make a very good podcast. It might make a good sort of esoteric paper, but won't make such a great podcast. And the important point is for you just to get some handle on this, but also to know that when I make these claims, I have looked into them, and you do realise they're on the internet, of course, that people make stuff up and give it out as though it was gospel truth, and you have to watch out for that. But you can look these things up for yourself and see that I'm not fibbing. Okay, there's an element in this paper that in which Rupert Soames, if in fact he did pen this, complains really about what a hard life it is to be a outsource operation. And there's a big concern about the matter of risk. And yeah, he has a little whinge, the writer of this Serco paper. Let me give you item 9, the matter of risk, on the matter of risk. Quote, a large number of companies have lost tens of millions, or in Serco's case, hundreds of millions of pounds on UK government contracts in recent years, mainly because the market for the supply of government services has become much more competitive. And government has become too good for its own good at transferring risks, often completely unmanageable, to its suppliers. At that point, I've added a comment in my notes, and I've put, so much for free market, inverted commas. People always find ways to game the system. And then Soames complains. Quote, this weakness has been painfully exposed in the last year by the capital markets. In the last 12 months, some 8.4 billion, or 50% has been wiped off the value of the largest public companies, which have a significant involvement supplying services to the UK government, whilst the FT index rose 15%. There he's having a whinge. The share prices are not as great as they'd like them to be. So working for the government's a bit of a pain, according to this. And Serco did it almost go bump just prior to Soames being employed, and so he's probably sort of competent at what he does within this ghastly sphere, and managed to bring Serco back from the brink. Serco, incidentally, I should remark, is one of those companies that's been pilloried at the moment with questions in Parliament about its incompetence in delivering COVID-19 test and trace and so forth. It seems to have had a very large amount of public money without too much by way of competition, tendering and so forth. And I know a figure that's bandied around is 12 billion. This is an awful lot of money. So, and in fact, Soames has been on the telly claiming that they've actually done rather well and that they're being libelled by Marxist alternative media, claiming that they've made a pig's ear of it. But I would say that it's pretty demonstrable that they haven't made a great job of what they're doing. And corruption is the name of the game at the moment. Incidentally, in the context of the EHRC report on the Labour Party and anti-Semitism and all the rest of it, when I was investigating that, I decided to look at the commissioners of the EHRC, the people who ultimately carry the can, and I noticed at least one of those commissioners, possibly not still in post, but certainly fairly recently, was in fact somebody who's pretty well connected with Serco. And of course, it wouldn't be in Serco's interest for a Labour government of the Corbyn shade to have come in power in 2019, or to have any kind of credibility as we move forward into the future. Because such a government would probably phase out this whole outsourcing racket. So it's just a little aside there, you know, that Serco is not squeaky clean, and neither is the EHRC. I'm going to move on to the contradiction between the neoliberal facade that both government and corporations adopt on the one hand, and the actual nature of what's going on behind the mask on the other. Neoliberalism, in its various articulations, are all for small government. Ronald Reagan famously said that government is the problem. It's not what can government do to solve the problem. Government is the problem. Mrs. Thatcher, of course, got there before him. These are people who are influenced by Hayek and Buchanan and Friedman and so on. And the contradiction is pretty evident in the Serco document as well as in the government document. And certainly this whole relationship is one of complex bureaucracy and rather than a complete free market which nobody ever interferes with. It's quite the contrary. And also a fairly big government, also fairly concentrated power. Even though government and corporation in it become one kind of locus of power. Here's an example. And interestingly, it's to do with Brexit. And item 25 of the Serco paper goes as follows. As the UK advances towards Brexit, it is clear that there will be the need for a whole lot more government as we take back control. Take back control is in inverted commas. With this in mind, we believe that there is an urgent need to rethink the relationship between the UK government and its suppliers. Which, of course, is what the gist of the paper is and what the ultimate thrust of the cabinet paper is, the outsourcing playbook. But, and now comes the contradiction, quote, encourage a more vibrant and competitive market for government services, one in which Serco would be an enthusiastic participant. So you see, they're asking for more competition, which of course is the god of the free market. But they also want a constraint on competition. And the entire document is a plea for various constraints that make it all a little bit more favourable to the corporations, given that the government has a supplier's monopoly and huge funds at its disposal. And the ability, therefore, to impose quite stringent conditions. So there's an attempt to place that in a framework through bureaucracies, and there's no way this can be done without bureaucracies. On the one hand, and on the other hand, this call for competition, which is an essential feature of the free market. Now, in the actual way this has been playing out in the pandemic, given emergency powers and so forth that the government has taken unto itself or has got the commons to give it, a number of contracts and some very, very large contracts have been handed out in a nepotistic and cronyist fashion without competition. I'll just mention that, which of course is pretty fascistic. A certain degree of competition might at least have the advantage of attenuating some of this concentration of power. Let me summarise then. An examination of these two documents shows that there's a very deep resonance between the corporations and their corporate think tanks and the Tory government, to the extent that policy is written at the very least with a great deal of input from the corporations. And we can see that many of their requests were granted by just a simple comparison between the documents. We do, however, see that we need to understand the dynamic of the relationship, of the entanglement between corporate and state power, as not being just a straightforward mergence into a single sort of monolithic entity without any internal parts, without any internal subsystems. We do find that is not a useful way to look at what's going on. And then there is it kind of straightforwardly Hegelian, with a limited number of interactions, or a very simple kind of interaction ultimately. But there's a whole range of interactive possibilities in an ongoing dynamic, in a Heraclitean flux, or a Nietzschean will to power scenario, or a Whiteheadian process unfolding. It also jumps out at us willy-nilly that in our current situation, that the lip service paid to neoliberal, small government, free market ideology conceals the reality of what those relationships are, of what that entanglement is, and of what that concentration of power is. I think at this point I would want to take on board David Harvey's suggestion that neoliberalism is a class project in its claims that it repudiates mass society and therefore feels justified in projects which attenuate the power of trade unions, that in fact it is attempting to reduce the possible power of the working class. The examples of Margaret Thatcher's war on the NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers, and Ronald Reagan's war on the air traffic control operatives in the US makes the point. And in both these cases, union power was broken by decisive action. And certainly in the case of Thatcher's war on the miners, the coercive wing of the state was fully involved, in that troops and police were brought to bear and engaged in pitched battle with the miners way back then in the 1980s. I think we need to take that seriously, and that is the job that the anti-mass society tropes in neoliberal discourse are about. That's what they're for. At the same time, as we've seen by comparing these two documents, neoliberalism, in insisting that all public services are delivered by corporations, is playing into fascism. And of course, fascism is ultimately a doctrine which mobilises mass society to serve the interests of capital. In other words, it too is a class project. So the actual nature of this dynamic relationship between corporations and government is one which requires both a repudiation of mass society and mass action, particularly of the trade unionist type, but also in the hands of Buchanan, of the civil rights type, at the same time as playing into an ideology that will mobilise mass society around the flag, around the nation, and around an ethno-state, for instance. So there's a huge contradiction right at the heart of all this game. And you have to conclude that the neoliberal story is precisely that. It's a cover story. And underneath it, we see a rather dangerous concentration of power, wealth and power, going on. And the justification, of course, has got many elements. But one element is that the market does everything better. The case of Carillion, of course, is the counter to this claim, as are the many examples of cock-ups perpetrated by corporations and companies that have been charged with dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic and paid out of public funds to do so. All of this is still very much in the air at the moment. This week, Michael Gove, answering questions in Parliament, went off on a rant about the superiority of the private sector and how terrible it would be if Labour got into power and didn't want to let the private sector do all these wonderful things with the utmost efficiency. Actually, he was pulled up by the Speaker for doing politics and polemicising and engaging in rhetoric instead of answering the question that he was asked. So they're still pushing this line. And it's ideological, there's no doubt about it. You start looking a little bit more deeply at how things are going on, and it's a story plastered on the top of a very different reality. There's a lot more can be said about this, and I recommend, if you've got the time, that you take a little squint at these documents, and they are freely available on the internet, and have a little read. Actually, the government document is quite comical, just in the way it's presented. It's a typical corporate document with an aesthetic that I actually find sort of, I don't know what the word is there, kind of risible. You know, it's kind of vulgar in its glossy sophistication. And there's lots of pictures of attractive people working in offices. And it's just a personal foible. I fucking hate that corporate speak. I think it's pretty fucking empty when push comes to shove. And But what will be apparent and what will jump out at you is just the extent of the bureaucracy it takes to manage this stuff, and the number of problems that it encounters, and that the market isn't this invisible hand, this wonderful magic system, but something requiring very intricate micromanagement. And there are many, many government bodies involved in overseeing this and that. There's the Competition and Markets Authority. There's a sort of a, there's an office that deals with procurement, and there's audit, the audit, National Audit Office, and the Cabinet Office itself, and blah, 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 various parliamentary committees that need to be addressed. Not to mention the great departments of state which actually commission the various services. On the other side, of course, you've got the think tanks and the people that they employ. I should mention that the Serco Institute hosted the preliminary discussions on the outsourcing playbook with various interested parties and government departments and so forth. There's a lot more could be said about this. There are so many ins and outs and intricacies that come to light when you do this kind of comparison at the nitty-gritty level. But what I'm going to do to wind up, just to make this podcast digestible, and it was always in danger of dying under the detail, and I hope I've done a reasonable job of paring it down. Of course, you can check all this stuff for yourself. The documents in question are freely available on the internet, and they are worth a glance, even if you don't have the time to go through some quite long documents. The Serco submission to the Public Administration Constitutional Affairs Committee of the House of Commons is pretty short. It's 3 pages or 4, but just a few pages. It's not very long. The government paper, the outsourcing playbook, is a little bit longer and quite involved, and with lots of references, external references to policies and models and legal stuff and so forth. But it's worth a look. It's worth a look just to grab the aesthetics of how the government thinks makes it look business-like and competent. To my eyes, it's kind of risible, very glossy. They paid a lot of money for it, but it never gets beyond Madison Avenue shallowness. You may or may not see that, but that's what I see, and it kind of makes me puke, to be honest. Okay, just to wind it up then, I'm going to read the conclusion that I actually wrote. Most of this stuff isn't scripted, by the way. I've just got notes, and I made my mind up about the best order to put the salient points in. But this little concluding remark I have written, here we go. Neoliberalism was always more of an ideological cover than a fully realised actuality. Certainly now in the UK, it has morphed into a command economy in which power is focused in the hands of a government corporation's symbiosis, with revolving doors for personnel and with corporations involved in policy making. Baroque bureaucracies are at the core of all this, the very thing that Thatcher and Reagan spoke against. The spokespersons for this setup still polemicise for free markets, which, however, mystifies what is going on under the hood, but also produces stark contradictions. I come to this conclusion by trying to find out in detail what the relationship between Serco, an outsourcing corporation, and the government actually is. I do this by means of a fairly close scrutiny of the actual texts produced by a typical corporation and the government themselves. The situation I thereby describe is a form of capitalism, that Mussolini would have celebrated. The next episode in this series, What is Fascism?, will take a psychological look at the character formations of fascists and the mass psychology of fascism. It will organise itself around the proposition that fascism is the weaponisation of the death instinct. And I'll be utilising, in a fairly free way, the work of Eric Fromm, who wrote about the psychology of fascism actually during World War II, and Wilhelm Reich, who wrote a book called The Mass Psychology of Fascism. Both of these characters were Freudian Marxists, but very different from each other, and very interesting. And as I say, I'll be using them, their work, but not in an exegetical way, but as inspiration and launching off point. I hope you found that useful. Thank you for listening. Make knowledge great again, and be well. And thank you to our patrons who've been bunging us a few bob to keep this thing going.